Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is life really like for the average Pakistani? And what are the country's chances of shaking off its violent history and creating a stable, peaceful society? Nicholas Schmidl won a fellowship in 2006 that paid for him to live in Pakistan for 2 years, learn the language, and write about what he witnessed. From his home base in Islamabad, he traveled all over the country, visiting Taliban training camps, freedom fighters, even witnessing a public lashing. He was in the country when former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto was assassinated at a campaign rally, but deported a few weeks later after publishing an article about his experiences in the New York Times magazine. His new book details the whole experience. It's called To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. And Nicholas Schmidl is currently a fellow at the New America Foundation. Nick, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Can you talk about what drew you to want to study Pakistan in the first place?
To be honest, it was by pure accident. I had spent the previous summer, before I received the fellowship that you mentioned, I'd spent the previous summer in Iran studying Persian at Tehran University and became sort of totally infatuated and obsessed with Iran, and I originally received this fellowship to go spend 2 years in Iran. Unfortunately, about a week after I received the fellowship, Ahmadinejad was elected, and the prospects that the Iranian government was going to give a blonde 27-year-old American and his American wife a visa for 2 years just to sort of roam the country and explore Iran's, you know, identity questions and questions of ethnic identity was very, very, very unlikely. And so I went back to the foundation and said more or less that, you know, the only way I'm going to get to go anywhere is if we find a new country. And I said, I think the Pakistan might have some ethnic and some identity issues as well. What if I go there? And so there it was that I left on Valentine's Day, about 3 months after being married, Valentine's Day 2006, and arrived in Karachi for the first time.
So you didn't have a lot of time to get ready, but can you talk about how you prepared yourself for this trip?
Sure. I because I spoke Persian, the similarities between Persian and Urdu are that they share an alphabet, they have some of the same nouns, and there's some basic structure. So I studied a little bit of Urdu before I left and then planned to study intensive Urdu when I arrived. And just kind of got on the phone and called every Pakistani who lived in the Washington, D.C. area. At the time that this was in early 2006, the current Pakistani ambassador to the United States, Hussein Haqqani, was a fellow at one of the think tanks in D.C. So, you know, I spent a couple hours with him talking and just sort of tried to pick people's brains. But in the process, wanted to go in almost as fresh as could be, wanted to go in knowledgeable and have some base of knowledge, but be totally open to forming my own analysis. And the brevity of the time that I had to prepare, I think, actually enabled that more than it would have if I'd had, say, a year to get ready.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't want to be influenced by what other people had gone and reported.
Right. And you know, the other factor was that there was so little reporting that was being done. There had been a couple of books that had been written about Pakistan, but they were very academic. They were sort of think tank books, and they were great for building up a base of knowledge, but they didn't tell you anything about Pakistanis. They didn't tell you anything about life on the Pakistani street. And so that was really what I wanted to go do and really what I wanted to explore and write about.
And in terms of your ability to move about the country, you were at something of an advantage in that you were not a working journalist in the traditional sense.
That's right. You know, when this foundation that sent me, it's called the Institute of Current World Affairs, and since 1925, they've been sending people on long-term fellowships with the notion, as you mentioned earlier, go there for at least 2 years, wherever your country is, learn the local language, don't come home and write about what you see. They have always, because of their obscurity and because the fellows are fully subsidized, the foundation is the money for the foundation comes from the Crane plumbing enterprise, if you will, and so that was always an issue there, whether you were a journalist or whether you were an academic or what you were. So the Pakistanis were very unsure, and I applied as a journalist, and they said, no, you're not really a journalist. And I applied as an academic, and they said, no, you're really not an academic. So I eventually won an affiliation with a think tank based in Islamabad, a very, very pro-government think tank that was actually involved or part of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, was very close with the ISI, Pakistan's intelligence service, and for some reason or another, they decided to host me for the 2 years I was there.
So how much monitoring did you have by intelligence agents?
It depends. It waxed and it waned. After specific trips, for the first 8 months, I didn't really feel like I had any monitoring at all. After the first trip that I took to Baluchistan, which is a massive province in southwestern Pakistan that borders Afghanistan and Iran, the capital city of Baluchistan, Quetta, is where many U.S. intelligence officials believe that Mullah Omar and even some senior al-Qaeda leaders are based. This is the sort of, this is always, since 2001, this has been assumed to be the base of the Taliban's operations in southern Afghanistan in the city of Quetta. But there's another dynamic to the province of Baluchistan, which is that the Baluchis who live there have been waging a low-level ethnic insurgency against the Pakistani state almost since its inception. And so after that first trip, I was in Baluchistan for a couple of weeks and came back, and that's when I knew that I had now gotten on the intelligence agency's radar, and I knew that my phones were being listened to, and I knew that, you know, we had intelligence agents dropping by the house and asking our hosts, you know, where we lived and who we are and what we were doing there, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. How seriously did you take that as a threat to your safety or to your ability to do what you went there to do?
It was rattling at first, no doubt about it. I was out having dinner with my wife one evening and got a call from someone named Churo, who presented himself as Churo, C-H-U-R-R-O, and he said that he wanted to meet me and he wanted me to teach him English. And I asked him where he got my number, and he said, you know, that he'd stumbled upon it, and that he was working at a bank in Islamabad. So the next day I called the bank, and the bank said, no, that person doesn't, no one named Churo exists. And in fact, Churo, the word Churo means dagger in Urdu, and no one is named Churo. So at that point I thought, okay, all right, so now I see that they're trying to get into my head, and they've done an okay job of it. But it was also, you sort of knew that was par for the course. You knew that if you went to certain areas that, in the days after, you were going to be visited by intelligence agencies. They were going to make some calls just to let you know that they knew that you were watching them. They were watching you.
So you made some extraordinary contacts while you were there. Can you talk for a minute about what you did with anybody that you would meet to gain their trust and to make sure that they knew that you just wanted to understand them?
Right. Speaking Urdu was a huge, huge bridge builder. Even in the beginning when my Urdu wasn't fantastic, just being able to say salam alaikum, ask some basic, you know, how are you, what's your name, you just kind of be able to establish some basic conversation. And then oftentimes the Pakistani elite or educated can speak English, so you could switch to English. But just that initially showed them that you were sincere about trying to understand Pakistan and about trying to understand their language and their culture. So that was a huge stepping stone. The second of which was not in Islamabad too often, but I usually always dressed in local clothes when I was traveling outside of Islamabad, often in the shalwar kameez, which is the very, you know, baggy pants and tunic outfit that you see Pakistani men wearing. So if I was outside, particularly outside of Islamabad, as I would roll into one of these villages, speaking Urdu, wearing local clothes, first people would kind of wonder, you know, who is this guy? But by the same token, people were a little bit more open and a little bit more warm.
And from the outset, people seemed more than willing to separate the way they treated you from their views on the U.S. government and the U.S. military in particular. Did you expect that?
I expected a little bit because I had had that bit of conventional wisdom rattled the previous summer when I'd been in Iran. And I realized that, you know what, when people are denouncing the United States and burning effigies of American presidents, they really are very seldomly angry at Americans per se. It's much more, I mean, it's 99.9% of the time directed at the American government. So it wasn't overly surprising, but it did, it was amazing that these people who had spent their lives, whether it be fighting the United States in Afghanistan or just denouncing Americans' intervention in Pakistan, that they would be so open and so receptive and so hospitable to an American.
You often traveled with a fixer, in most cases a local journalist. Can you talk about the kind of information that they were able to provide for you?
Yeah, the fixer, you know, everyone in Pakistan has, every foreign journalist in Pakistan works with a fixer to some extent. You just can't get around. You can't get on the phone and make appointments and find out where things are without one. Now, most journalists who are based in Islamabad will have one fixer who speaks Urdu, and they will travel all over the country with that same fixer. I, for one, didn't have the kind of finances to keep someone on staff working for me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So I would hire someone wherever I was traveling to. So say I was going to Multan, which is a city in the southern part of Punjab. You know, rather than flying there with a fixer who can sort of hold my hand through the airport and whatnot, I would just get on a public bus, and I would have arranged previously to meet this Pakistani in Multan. So he would, you know, I'd ride the public bus. I could speak Urdu, so I could get around and feel very comfortable moving around like that. And then he provided several things. He provided the proficiency in the local language. So Pakistan, only about 11% of Pakistanis actually speak Urdu at home. And so most people are speaking either Baluchi or Pashto or Sindhi or Punjabi or Saraiki or one of the other small languages spoken by the minor ethnic groups. So this individual would be able to talk to local politicians in their own language, which was, again, a huge factor in getting them to build trust and open up to me, who was by way, you know, who was kind of their attachment. The other thing, though, is it brought another pair of eyes. It brought another mind to assess whether we should be driving down this road at dark, or whether, you know, this particular neighborhood was smart to go at lunchtime, because at lunchtime was when, you know, was when the gangs came out and they were selling drugs. I mean, it was just that local gut level, street level knowledge that was totally invaluable and totally, unreplaceable with anyone who wasn't immediately from that area.
And we should say that life in Islamabad is radically different from life in many of the provincial areas.
It is. Life in Islamabad, actually, a friend of mine dubbed Islamabad low self-esteemabad. It is very, very, very quiet. It is, the streets are clean. They are very, at right angles. It's mostly bureaucrats that are living there in large houses on large plots, and it doesn't feel like Pakistan. They say that Pakistan officially starts 15 minutes away from Islamabad, which is where Rawalpindi, which is a distinctly sort of teeming, dirty, crazy Pakistani city, starts. So you're right. I mean, Pakistan and Islamabad are often quite different.
And Pakistan is also a country where the government centered in Islamabad has never had full control over everything since its inception.
Right. The western border has always, and even before Pakistan's inception, when the British ruled Pakistan, they ruled the western border of Pakistan, that being throughout Baluchistan and throughout today's Northwest Frontier Province and the federally administered tribal areas. They ruled these areas using local proxies, using tribal elders, mostly tribal elders. They used to try and not leverage or sort of take advantage of the power of the religious leaders or the mullahs. And this was a development that's happened in more recent years. So the Pakistani government has never had total control, and which is why now many of the problems that we're seeing there are beginning to manifest.
Yeah, what do you think about the U.S. government's sudden about-face in terms of its confidence in the Pakistani government to take back some of these areas that the Taliban now control?
I think that the U.S. government is very encouraged. I think that they have since late 2001, shortly after 9/11, have been asking the Pakistanis for help. The Pakistanis have been saying, you know, we're doing all we can, and thousands of Pakistani soldiers have been killed fighting the Taliban and fighting Al-Qaeda over the course of the past several years. So the Pakistanis say, you know, we're making our sacrifices, and yet the U.S. government has never been satisfied. So now that the army is really pushing against the militants, there is a sense that, okay, well, maybe the Pakistanis finally get it. Maybe they finally realize the severity of the threat.
Nicholas Schmidl is my guest. His new book is called To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. We'll return to our conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible in part by SMU summer camp programs, helping kids create, design, and think in fun new ways in Plano and on the Dallas main campus. Details online at smu.edu/camp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is a fellow at the New America Foundation, Nicholas Schmidl. His new book is called To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Nick, one of the militant leaders that you developed a relationship with was the late Red Mosque leader, Abdul Rashid Ghazi. Why do you think, first of all, that he was even willing to meet with you?
Why was he willing to meet with me?
Yeah.
It's a good question, and a question that I kind of have constantly asked myself. I think that if we go back to what I was saying earlier, it was the perception that I was sincere about learning, that I wasn't going in, to sort of bait him with a question that would sound extremely radical that I could then sort of run back and insert in my story that was closing that afternoon. So the ability to go in and just start from the beginning, to start from the very beginning of his life and kind of work through, and we probably had six or seven conversations that would be, 2 hours or if not or more in length, that, it was just a genuine interest in learning more about this guy and learning more about the movement that he was presiding over and learning more about where that fit into the larger framework of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, et cetera. And so I think that he, for some reason, just took a liking to me and opened up to me.
What were those meetings like? I mean, you had to go into these knowing that this was a terrorist and a dangerous man in his own right, and yet you had to also be able to trust him enough to have a normal conversation with him.
Right. About 2 years before our first meeting, the Pakistani government had alleged that Abdul Rashid Ghazi and an Egyptian militant who was very close with Osama bin Laden were involved in a plot to bomb the U.S. Embassy, the Pakistani National Assembly, all these major buildings, the ISI headquarters, the Army House, all these major buildings in Islamabad and Rawalpindi. And Ghazi had escaped and been on the run, and since then had been holed up inside of the mosque, and the government more or less told Ghazi that if you leave, we're going to either arrest you or kill you. And Ghazi's father had actually been assassinated inside the mosque in 1998. So he, so that was always in the back of my mind for sure, that who was this guy, what was, Ghazi openly said that he was friends with this Egyptian terrorist. He just said they didn't have anything to do with the plot. And, I used to call ahead and ask Ghazi to make sure that everything was going to be cool, that none of his sort of young vigilantes were going to come chasing after me. Increasingly, I became more and more paranoid. I would, as I was leaving the mosque, I would look under my car to make sure that nothing untoward, say, bombs or anything had been placed underneath. And I had a special SIM card, that I used to put into my mobile phone and make calls that I used to only call Ghazi so that my main SIM card that I knew the government was listening to wouldn't be able to track my conversations and know when I was going in and whatnot.
And he was a guy who was well aware that his days were numbered.
He was well aware what?
That his days were numbered.
He was. He knew that they were building momentum inside the mosque. He knew that eventually the government was going to do something. He knew that they were going to push the government too far. And they did. If I could, give a quick timeline. Ghazi's father, in 1998, Ghazi and his father went to Kandahar and met Osama bin Laden. And this is a critical turning point in Ghazi's life. Ghazi, in 1998, the same year, was working at UNICEF, and Ghazi had a master's degree in international relations. He spoke fluent English. He was a very educated and very savvy one of the educated and savvy son of this mullah. When they came back, though, the father started speaking in favor of bin Laden. Ghazi was transformed by the experience, and that sort of, that was the critical turning point in his life. So he used to tell me that the government knows that if they come into the mosque, that it's going to be bloody. And they know that, and Ghazi used to say, there are two ways that this Islamic revolution that's bound to happen is going to happen in Pakistan. Either the government does it itself and it's peaceful, or the people do it and it's bloody. And Ghazi used to say that, if they kill me, it will only expedite it. It will only sort of speed up this process.
You also developed ties to the head of the Taliban's political wing, Maulana Fazlur Rahman, and he told you that he preferred politics to violence to achieve his ends. Did you believe that?
Yeah, Maulana Fazlur Rahman was in a very, very, very precarious situation. Maulana Fazlur Rahman heads the Jamaat-e-Ulama Islam Party, the JUI party, that in the 1990s and even in the early 2000s was seen as one of the political fronts for the Taliban and various other militant organizations in both Pakistan and in Afghanistan. He used to refer to the Taliban and to Mullah Omar and the Taliban in Afghanistan as quote our boys. But because of the massive and significant cultural and religious and social revolutions that were taking place throughout the Pakistan-Afghanistan border from 2001 until today that have been taking place, Maulana Fazlur Rahman suddenly was the target of the Taliban because he wasn't taking their side enough, because he was sitting in parliament, because he was part of the establishment. And, you know, one of his colleagues said to me, the problem is that the government thinks that Maulana Fazlur Rahman is the Taliban's man. The Taliban thinks that Maulana Fazlur Rahman is the government's man, and in fact, he's no one's man, and he's stuck. He's made like a sandwich in between these two people. And frankly, if there's two parties that you don't want to be stuck inside that are known for their indiscriminate use of force, it's the Pakistani army and the Taliban, and that's exactly where Maulana Fazlur Rahman stands right now.
In terms of infighting between different extremist groups and even among certain groups, there are some Americans who would look at that and think, well, this is a good sign. It means that they're going to weaken each other before we even have to go in and do anything. You don't necessarily see that to be the logical conclusion.
No, I mean, I think that if we look back, it could happen. There are certain parts of the country. I mean, the Taliban and where the extremists are strong in Pakistan is very regional and very localized, and the dynamics in each area of the country are very different. But if we look at sort of what happened in Afghanistan in the 1990s, you had warlords fighting one another, you had a scene of total chaos and an absolute lack of security, and then the biggest and baddest and nastiest, the Taliban, Mullah Omar's Taliban, came in and established law and order because everyone knew that they had monopolized the use of violence. And so right now, when you see the groups that are fighting, I often wonder who's going to be the bigger, nastier party that's going to eventually persevere and establish law and order. And, you know, like I said, when you look at the fact that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are already fighting, it makes me quiver my boots a little bit to think that who's going to be the one to come in.
Can you talk for a minute about how regular Pakistanis, those who are not involved in extremist activities, feel about the Taliban as an idea as compared with the way they feel about the Taliban stranglehold on power in certain areas?
I think that's a crucial distinction. You're right. The Pakistanis, many Pakistanis love the idea of the Taliban. They love the idea of these sort of righteous, very basic, poor, humble Muslims trying to implement Sharia or Islamic law in their hometowns and in their areas of, you know, up and down the border area. So that earns them envy and respect from average Pakistanis. But average Pakistanis don't want to actually live under a government ruled by the guys with the turbans and the guns and the beards. And a Pakistani journalist said something really illuminating to me in one of the first few weeks that I was in Pakistan. He said 99.9% of Pakistanis love the idea of the Taliban fighting the Americans in Afghanistan, fighting the Pakistanis in the tribal areas. But, you know, he said 100% of them would be scared and would hate the day that the Pakistanis or that the Taliban are actually in the streets of Islamabad or Karachi.
What do you see as the appeal of the movement to young people?
The movement of young, say again, I'm sorry.
The appeal of the Taliban for younger people who are getting recruited in.
Well, there are two sides to that. I think that the Taliban were able to tap into a vein over the course of, you know, in 2003, 4, 5, 6, you saw young people that were joining the Taliban in many ways for the same reasons that a young man in the United States would join the army. They would join for something. They would join for the notion of being able to fight for something bigger than themselves, for a life of adventure, for the camaraderie of their friends, for the charisma of their leaders. I mean, all these same factors were there, and it was amazing and a little contentious back at home when I brought this issue up. My father, who's a Marine two-star general, and my brother, who was a young first lieutenant in the Marines, and, you know, they said, well, it's not the same. And I said, well, I'm not saying that it's the same at a sort of at a normative level, but it is the same at a descriptive level as to why they're doing it. And so I think that does play. I think the Taliban, to some extent, though, have overplayed their hand. And young people, you know, we have to remember that Pakistan is the only country in the Muslim world where tens of thousands of people have poured out into the streets over the past 2 years to demand the rule of law and independent judiciary and whatnot. And so this is a deeply, this is a country that wants overwhelmingly to live according to liberal values, and yet because the government can't control, can't sort of enjoy the monopoly over violence, you see these other groups threatening that idea.
I think it's hard for a lot of Americans to understand what the draw would be of Sharia law for people who would seem to be really constricted by its mandates. Can you help us understand that?
Yeah, I mean, Sharia law is Islamic law. So if you ask a Muslim if they want to live according to Sharia law, everyone will say yes. The problem is that those who are implementing Sharia law want more than Sharia law. They want to be, they want to terrorize the population into submission. And so if we look at the example of Swat, which is right now the area where the Taliban and the Pakistani army are fiercely engaged in a fierce battle, the Taliban said, all we want is Sharia and Swat. And then the government said, okay, we'll implement Sharia, and the government established what are called Qazi courts, Q-A-Z-I. And when they established the Qazi courts, these were the local courts that were going to be implementing and ruling according to Sharia. And the Taliban would go in there, and the judgment would go against them, and they'd go storming out and saying, oh, you know, these Qazi courts are corrupt and fixed. So at that point, you realize that they wanted more than just Qazi courts. They wanted more than just Sharia. And you're right, too. They took it to the next level when they were lashing women. There was a scene in which they lashed a 17-year-old girl who had refused the marriage proposal of a young Talib. And there was a video taken of this flogging that was taken on a camera phone and distributed around the country. And this was the first hint that the Taliban had overplayed their hand, because for a week, the editorials and the news shows changed the tone and were no longer discussing whether, you know, the U.S. airstrikes and drone strikes in Pakistan were a violation of Pakistani sovereignty, or they weren't hawking anti-Indian and anti-American conspiracies, but they were talking about what the heck the Taliban were doing and why the heck the government couldn't get in there and do anything about it.
There is talk now that the army has finally sort of turned around in its support so that it really is fully behind the Pakistani government. Is it oversimplification to assume that things have changed that quickly overnight from within the ranks of the army?
Of course. I mean, it's always been oversimplification to say that the army and the intelligence agencies are working with the Taliban. You've got a 700,000-man army. And the senior leadership, even the senior leadership, is conflicted. I mean, the head of the army right now, General Ashraf Ghani, who many American, Pakistani, South Asia hands will tell you is the ultimate arbiter of what direction Pakistan goes in the next 6 months or next year. You know, he was running his last job before he became the chief of army was the head of the ISI, the top intelligence agency. So Pakistanis are overall split in terms of loyalties and thinking whether they really think that it's worth shedding Pakistani blood to fight against Talibs, and whether, you know, whether they're doing this at America's bidding and whatnot. So to think that those conflicts wouldn't also play out in an army that's more than a million or more than a half a million people, I think is somewhat short-sighted and naive for sure.
Benazir Bhutto, of course, famously had taken a very hard line in promising to fight the Taliban. Do you think, given the struggles that her husband, who ultimately took over that power, has had in following through with that, do you think she would have been as successful as she promised?
No. The problem is that any Pakistani leader right now, to be able to wage a successful counterinsurgency against the Taliban, you have to have popularity. You have to have convinced the Pakistani people that it's their war. She was lobbying for this, no doubt about it. And she, I'm sure, would have enjoyed more success than her husband, Asif Ali Zardari, who, according to a recent poll, has an approval rating of 19%. 19% is not indicative of being able to get the country on your shoulders. The problem, though, is that because of the intense involvement of U.S. policy in Pakistan over the course of the past 7 years, any leader that comes in, if they come in and are popular and seen as being independent, soon become more or less tainted, because Pakistanis are really furious over the idea of American meddling in Pakistani policy. So then whatever approval rating they had coming in soon begins to chip away. And this is the predicament that we're beginning to see, and that I fear we're going to see with Nawaz Sharif, who is another two-time former prime minister, who's kind of waiting in the wings right now to take over power and probably will do so over the next year or two. And he's incredibly popular, but the question becomes, when he takes over, then what happens to all that popularity and how is, if he's able to consolidate and hold on to that.
So what sort of guidance should that provide the United States in deciding to apply more, not just military aid, but even humanitarian aid within Pakistan?
Well, the humanitarian aid is critical. The Pakistani government just doesn't have the resources right now to be able to get into these camps of these internally displaced people, the refugees who have had to leave their homes in Swat because of the fighting. And are now, there are, I believe, 400,000 people that are in these camps south of Swat in the northwest frontier province. And the problem right now is that the government doesn't have the services to get in there. And so the organizations that we see that are actually in there working, there's one organization that's the welfare wing of Lashkar-e-Taiba, the group that was responsible for the Mumbai attacks last November. And so that U.S. assistance in the humanitarian realm is incredibly wise, incredibly smart, and more than welcome. I mean, U.S. approval ratings and popularity rankings after the 2005 earthquake in Pakistan were skyrocketing for a period there. So that is very important, and I think that it's very welcomed. In terms of how you handle the political involvement, it's sort of delicacy and tact, I think, are the key words. And being able to involve yourself, the U.S. is not going to extricate itself from Pakistan anytime soon, but that involvement needs to be very deft and sort of behind the curtains and not overt and not giving the impression to Pakistanis that they're being ruled from Washington.
Nicholas Schmidl is my guest. His new book is called To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think is made possible in part by SMU summer camp programs, helping kids create, design, and think in fun new ways in Plano and on the Dallas main campus. Details online at smu.edu/camp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Nicholas Schmidl. He is a fellow at the New America Foundation, and his new book is called To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. That is where we hear from Fareed, who asks if you would comment on the possibility of a Pakistani or an Iranian doing the same thing that you did, traveling to the U.S. for 2 years to study our culture. What kind of host do you think the United States would be?
That's a great question, actually. And unfortunately, I don't know that Americans would be as hospitable as Pakistanis or Iranians would be to me. And I think that it's unfortunate. I think that Pakistanis and Iranians, when I met them, would talk about how amazed they were at how friendly Americans were. But there is also a slight tinge of uncertainty. I don't want to say xenophobia is a very strong word, but I fear that it wouldn't be quite as easy.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with David in Dallas. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi there. My question is, with what had happened to Daniel Pearl, were you ever worried about your personal safety or, you know, being vulnerable in that type of situation?
Sure. I mean, I think that's a great question. The ghost of Daniel Pearl undoubtedly hovers over the city of Karachi, and any foreign journalist, specifically American journalist, and specifically an American journalist working on the same sorts of issues that Daniel Pearl was working on, is reminded over and over and over again, be careful. I've seen this before. I saw a guy, people would say to me, I saw a guy just like you who went through something similar. You know, all that being said, the most frightened I was for my personal safety was not in the company of the Taliban, was not in some remote corner of Pakistan, but was in the city of Karachi. Last summer, in August of 2008, 6-7 months after the Pakistani government had deported my wife and I, after I'd written the story in the New York Times magazine about the Taliban that they didn't like, I was allowed back, and I was allowed back to go write a story about a Sufi festival, a religious festival a few hours north of Karachi. And I was doing the piece for Smithsonian. It was a very sort of soft Pakistan story, just the kind of story the Pakistani government always said that there weren't enough of. And midway through that trip, we started receiving phone calls from one caller using the same phone number, pretending to be different people that didn't exist, a newspaper editor and a government official, wanting to meet with me. And it was a page pulled right out of the Daniel Pearl book, if you will. And about a half an hour later, after I was traveling again with a local fixer, a translator, and we ignored the calls, and about a half an hour later started receiving phone calls from friends of mine saying that they were watching television and local TV channels were reporting that I'd been kidnapped. So reading and hearing about your own kidnapping is about as scary as it can get. And so I cut my trip short and came back. The U.S. Embassy was very involved. They said that they were picking up all these internal communications that were mentioning my name, internal communications by the intelligence agencies that were mentioning my name. So they didn't know whether the intelligence agencies were trying to protect me from a threat or whether they were the threat. And it was a frightening and terrifying last 24 hours that I spent in Pakistan. So after being kicked out the first time and being pretty convinced that it was a bureaucratic issue, I left the second time. I thought, okay, you know, the whole kidnapping thing, whether it was a shot across the bow or whether it was forecasting intent, it rattled me enough to think that, okay, I think I might have to give myself some time before I go back to Pakistan anytime soon.
Well, certainly, Nick, your profile had changed between the time that you were deported and the time that you returned, to the extent that everyone at that point knew what you were doing there and what you were capable of finding out. But do you think the country had changed fundamentally as well in that time?
Well, that's a great question, because that's actually kind of what I went back to write about. I went back to write, there had been, so I was kicked out a week after Benazir Bhutto was assassinated, and about a month and a half after that, her party, the Pakistan People's Party, emerged major victors in a parliamentary election. The lawyers' movement had continued to gather steam. Musharraf's power was withering, and I thought, okay, well, this is the moment. I mean, we're seeing a civilian democracy take root. And yet just 2 nights before that incident with the phone calls and the kidnapping threats, I was sitting there with Benazir Bhutto's husband, Asif Ali Zardari, the night that Musharraf had resigned. And I thought, okay, well, this is it. You know, I'm meeting the guy who's to be the future president of Pakistan. And yet 2 days later realized that even though the civilian government was fully in charge, the military intelligence agencies were ultimately the arbiters of power in that country and probably will be for some time to come. And it left me feeling unfortunately much more despairing of the immediate future prospects of Pakistan than even when I had felt when I had arrived there a week earlier.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Praveen in Dallas. Hi, Praveen.
Hi. I was calling to find out what your guests thought about the reason why India and Pakistan took such divergent paths after they both got independence at the same time and were set up as democracies at the same time.
Any perspective on that, Nick?
Sure. There are several reasons. I don't think that you can, you know, really boil it down to one or two reasons. A couple of things that come to mind for me are, one of which is that governments in India have all sort of taken their course. Pakistan has not had a single peaceful, scheduled transition of power. Now, I think that probably further underwrites your question, is why is that not so? And I don't know. I mean, there are a couple of reasons. There have been substantial land reforms in India that were never enacted in Pakistan, meaning that even though there's gross differences in wealth in India, they're even more moderate than they are in Pakistan. In Pakistan, you've got a couple of you know, literally feudal lords, and hundreds of thousands of people living and toiling on their land. And these feudals, there is simply no room for a young upstart politician in Pakistan. They will always be connected to these feudal lineage. And so that's part of it. The military and the fact that the military has always been in power is another part. I mean, Pakistan has politically never been able to fully mature. And but I think it's a great question, and I don't know. The problem is when you start, the great thing about working in Pakistan is that it's not a politically loaded country. You can go there and report, and you aren't immediately branded as being on the right or on the left or anything. But I tell you what, when you start wading into Pakistan-India questions, it becomes a very polarizing debate just immediately.
We know the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan is famously porous. What is the border like between Pakistan and India?
The border between Pakistan and India is not nearly as porous. In fact, I think that it's, you know, probably one of the most militarized borders in the world. It's an incredible experience to leave Pakistan and go to India or vice versa. My wife and I, after being in Pakistan for about 7 or 8 months, decided to take the honeymoon that we'd never had the chance to take and to go to Rajasthan, which is one of the hottest parts of India, in June, which is probably the hottest time of the year. But it was the only opportunity we had. So we took a car to the border, the Wagah border, and walked across the border into India. And, you know, as the Pakistani border control were stamping our passports, we were leaving Pakistan, and they couldn't crack a smile. They were very gruff, very serious. And, you know, we crossed into India speaking the exact same language in a very, very familiar culture and people wearing similar clothes, and yet the Indian border guards were all smiles, welcome to our country, enjoy India. And the other amazing thing is that it took me almost 6 months initially to get a six-month visa to go to Pakistan, and it took me about 3 hours to get a 10-year tourist visa to go to India. And that, I think, is very reflective of the way the two countries welcome, sort of at a bureaucratic level, at an administrative level, deal with and welcome foreigners.
We have an email from Wayne in Dallas who asks, what do you think the chances are that continued military aid would go to fighting the Taliban as opposed to shoring up the border with India?
Yeah, this has been a constant question, and I don't know that there is or will be enough oversight over Pakistan's military expenditures and purchases that we can ever be totally sure. And I think that that's why you see members of Congress right now saying that we know we need to support the Pakistanis as they're fighting the Taliban, but we also need some safeguards, some assurance that the money that we're giving to them isn't going to A, you know, help their nuclear program, or B, purchase tanks and the sorts of weaponry that they would never use against the Taliban and would only use in the case of fighting India.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We go next to Sunita in Irving. Hi, Sunita.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Oh, very interesting discussion. I had two questions. I don't know if we have time for this, but I'll take the longer one first. Does your book, sir, take into consideration the two-facedness of the political leaders because of two reasons? Number one, they don't particularly want the country to progress because that would then mean their loss of control. And number two, they're busy filling their own coffers.
Nick, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I think this gets back to the point I mentioned a minute ago about the feudal system and the continuation of these large landholders that are in power. And as you mentioned, you know, ignorance is an empowering and is a way to hold people down. And the same reasons why the Taliban and their sort of religious cohorts in the border areas of Pakistan with Afghanistan don't want education, and they don't want, you know, they don't want any influence from outside, are the same reasons why some of Pakistan's more quote unquote enlightened political leaders who are sitting on these huge fields and have these, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who, you know, literally kiss their feet and kiss their hands as they pass through a crowd. The same reason why these people don't also want it to sort of spread education, see education administered throughout the country.
Given the government's ongoing struggles with controlling all of these extremist factions and, in fact, the encroachment to within 70 miles of the capital of Taliban forces, how secure do you think the government's nuclear weapons are from terrorist factions?
I don't mean to laugh at what is so obviously a serious question, but it's, you know, as I mentioned in the very beginning, I went to Pakistan trying to understand the sort of the street-level politics. And the question of the safety of the nuclear weapons is just one of those discussions that I never was really, never privy to any discussions that would tell me one thing or another. You know, Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, U.S. Admiral, a few weeks ago said that he was worried, but by the same token, he felt like the Pakistani government had it under control. And in this case, I would kind of defer to him. It is certainly something to fear, and it just also is sort of stratospheres above the level that I work.
Can you talk for a minute about what you think it would take to bring peace to the country? And is there any amount of international aid that really will make a difference there, or does it have to happen from within the ranks of Pakistani citizens?
It does have to happen from within the ranks. Humanitarian aid is welcome, no doubt about it. U.S. assistance to civilian institutions, to build up civilian institutions that have for so long been stomped upon by the Pakistani military, is also very welcome. As for the prospects of peace, they're just the idea of Pakistan, the idea of the country has never been sold to everyone, to every Pakistani. And as you travel the country and you talk to people, people don't identify themselves as Pakistanis first. They will identify themselves as say Pashtuns first, and then Muslims second, and then maybe their tribal pedigree third, and then third or fourth or fifth in that ranking of identities comes Pakistani. And so long as that is the way the Pakistanis see themselves, Pakistan will always be fighting with itself. It'll always be fighting sort of small insurgencies and ethnic insurgencies and religious extremists and whatnot.
Secretary of State Clinton, of course, this week is asking Americans to text with their cell phones and give $5 to provide aid for people who have been displaced within Pakistan. Do you think there is a will in the United States for individual people to make these contributions?
I'm not sure that there is, but I just want to say that is the kind of gesture that is going to go over very, very, very well in Pakistan.
Really?
That's the kind of gesture that will convince Pakistanis that the U.S. is not there to sort of colonize Pakistan and take over Afghanistan and, you know, take over the pipelines from the natural gas fields in Central Asia, which is always the concern of not even uneducated Pakistanis, but even some educated Pakistanis. So I think that those are the sorts of gestures that really go a long way, and that can be a turning point of the relationship between the Pakistani people and the American government.
Nicholas Schmidl is a fellow at the New America Foundation. His new book is called To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. Nick, it's been a great discussion. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.